Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's Creative Director. For today's episode, I interviewed Russell Baker, creator of the sustainability platform A Modern Remedy. On his website, amodernremedy.com, Russell writes long-form essays about various topics and their role in sustainability, including AI, social media, fashion, weather, and other subjects. In addition to his think pieces, in the last year, Russell started New Ways, a podcast pillar of the Modern Remedy platform that features interviews with changemakers that he feels are striving for a better tomorrow. At the end of 2023, we interviewed each other for our respective podcasts. My New Ways podcast was released a month ago, and for this episode, we turn the tables and I ask him about his motivations for creating A Modern Remedy. I love Russell's positivity and emphasis on solutions rather than just pointing out everything that's going wrong. A Modern Remedy's stated values are empathy, fairness, honesty, and sustainability, all of which shine through in his interviews and writing. As he states in the final episode of his first podcast season, AMR and New Ways aren't just joining the chorus of digital noise, they're a reprieve from doom scrolling. This is solution-focused media. Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast, Russell. And I wanted to start off by talking about the sort of hidden cost of technological energy consumption and the tax of the energy grid on the energy grid caused by computer networks, which you address in your piece on the environmental costs of AI. Could you go through your own take on that aspect of environmental concern, like the energy consumption that we usually don't think about that's sort of hidden behind the technology?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I just want to say it's an absolute pleasure to be here speaking with you. Very excited to get to this interview. It's a really good question. It's a really good question because most technological services have a cost to consumers, and they're costs that are not so transparent. A lot of the time, those costs relate to access of data. So a lot of the free, I'm air quoting here, free services that we get to use, social maps, multimedia, things like that, the trade-off is I'll give you my data, I'll give you my personal information, and then you give me access to whatever this service is without, you know, an upfront cost. And we've seen a bit of pushback by tech companies this year specifically with things like access to APIs, locking down of things, having to pay to play effectively what's happened over at Twitter, over at X. People don't like that. Consumers don't like that. But it's highlighting the true cost of these services. Why am I bringing all this up? Because there is a true cost to other services online as well. So things like the use of AI, things like Bitcoin, they require huge amounts of resources with every transaction, with every click. Microsoft is looking into spinning up micro nuclear reactors just to power the AI queries that it gets. And they're not alone. A lot of the big tech players are looking into ways that they can, you know, fund these things from an ecological perspective. Not the best thing going around. One recent study equated it to not now, but 2 to 3 years ago, the AI transactions that Google was making, so before Bard, before ChatGPT, and the whole AI arms race that we're currently in kicked off, when things are a little bit, you know, air quotes again, simpler, equated the energy consumption just of AI queries, equated to a small country, a small European country. I feel like it was Ireland, but it was on par with that. So how do we address that, to your point? Well, in my piece that I wrote there, the environmental benefits of AI, whether or not it outweighs the costs, I suggested that we take a look at sort of the, you know, nutrition industry. We take a look at what happens over there, I'm sure, in the US, much like in Australia and wherever else this episode will be consumed, the audience lives. There are strict regulations on what's in your food in terms of, you know, even just calories. And I suggested that we do something like that to increase the transparency of what do these transactions actually cost us in terms of environmental resources. You know, it's one thing to have an ESG strategy, but if you're affecting the environment with these really, really useful, really, really powerful queries, why not make that transparent as well? Why not show people, hey, by engaging in this, it's using this much carbon, and then we have to offset it by doing XYZ. So there's also a bit of a benefit to tech companies to be transparent, because you can say, hey, we're sustainably supplying, you know, whatever it is, AI or Bitcoin, which that's a whole nother story to get into.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of brings up like two, I'm kind of like seeing a division into two separate issues here. Like one is how are we powering the power grid to make that, you know? So, because I feel like the same thing kind of happens with electric cars. It's like, electric cars are great, but if those are putting more tax on the power grid and the power grid is powered by like oil, then you're still using that oil.
Exactly.
And then there's also the other side of selling the personal information. I feel like gets into the social and incentivization aspect of it, where people are essentially offering services for free, but the monetization part of it comes from selling personal information, not unlike like selling advertisement for, basically selling people's attention to advertisers.
I think just to sort of piggyback on that, where those services were, hey, this will work at scale, you know, network effect, everyone come join Facebook. It's where all your friends are. And that was optional. Right? You could choose to participate in that or not. You could choose your platforms. I don't know if you've had a look at your apps and services recently, but AI everywhere. It is every search engine, every application is showing, hey, there's an AI assistant here, AI something over there. And that's all great and well and good. But that choice is being taken away from the consumer because the low-hanging fruit is being dangled right in front of people's eyes. And they may not know or realize the consequences of engaging in using AI. I don't mean to sort of throw AI under the bus here, but just linking it back to the sustainability aspect.
Right. And what are your feelings of AI? You kind of asked me this question in the interview that we did together, but what do you think are the good uses of AI and the sort of bad uses of AI? And how do you use it for your own purposes?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I do see there being massive benefits to AI. And I think that purely is in the realm of things like administration, science, research, medicine. There's quite a lot of benefits there. You know, being able to really scale things up, to move quickly, really condense timeframes. A recent example of that obviously being, I'm not sure they used AI there, but, you know, how the whole world kind of got together and developed vaccines for COVID and were able to sort of really crunch those timelines. Well, what if we could do something like that but with like cancer research or you know, something that's just outside our grasp as going back to the article again, really let that loose on something like sustainability. And I know that sounds a bit strange considering what I just said, but what if it could solve some of those problems. Which is quite exciting. It really is. It's quite exciting. But then on the flip side, I think there are quite a lot of negatives. You know, we talked about, again, sustainability. Human obsolescence, I think, is a real sort of concern of mine. I'm no expert in AI. You know, I read what I read and do independent research. But I do see that as becoming something that I don't think people will engage in, but I think business owners will take a look at the books, the profit incentive, and go, well, why am I hiring these people, these humans, to do something that I could employ an AI to do? A lot of the time when having these conversations with colleagues or industry experts, one of the common sort of answers to that is, oh, you know, but look at photography, right? Look how that changed art, but people still paint, or look at the calculator, or look at the microwave. And I think that's looking at things on a very small scale. This isn't the invention of a new machine. This is the invention or replication of human thought, which is as far up the food chain as you can possibly go. This is a inflection point, I think, for humanity. I think that left to its own devices, AI isn't such a good thing, but harnessed correctly with proper guidance and regulation, it could be amazing. And then how do I use it as well? Mainly for administration purposes. So a lot of the things that I was doing pre this AI boom is now considered, you know, air quotes, AI. So in the audio show that I put together as well, there's transcription that's involved in there and different post-processing and things like that, which all of a sudden now when I log into those services say, this is powered by AI. And okay, so I haven't really changed much of my model there, so to speak.
And when you were talking about regulation, I was just going to add ethics, like, you know,
yes.
Like any new technology, you have to apply it with ethics or else, you know, you're using something for a bad purpose.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. You see that in the creative fields as well, where they were, I think, the first victims of this. A lot of their work was being repurposed, reused without their permission. They've gotten wise to it and they're beginning to look into licensing, which is great, which is really good, especially authors. Mm-hmm. But yeah, 100%. I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to ethics and ironically, it's going to come down to people fostering a sense of humanity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And to go into the human obsolescence issue of things, one thing I've been thinking about a lot is the paradox of the promise that new technology will make life easier, but instead it creates the fear of human obsolescence because we're dependent on income. And when you were talking about, you know, you're not worried about like people using it for that purposes, more like business owners just looking to cut costs, which again, it goes into like the ethical principles of like human exploitation. But yeah, how do you think we could bring these two issues into harmony? Like, what do you think is a solution towards like not fearing new technology because it's going to be replace people, but embracing new technology because it does make our life easier?
Mm. So I think I'll answer that in two bits. So first of all, the fear aspect, and that's, I don't want people to feel like a sense of hopelessness, but it's sort of like worrying about if a comet will hit Saturn and knock Saturn out of its orbit, and then that will have a kick-on effect. Like, it's so far out of you or I or anyone's listening to this as control that there's no point sort of worrying about it. It's like getting worried that a plane will fall out of the sky tomorrow. It's here. It's going to remain here. It's going to be used. That doesn't mean that the story has to end at that. There needs to be greater regulation, 100%. But even that's tricky, right? Because you look at things like CRISPR and gene editing and, you know, we can regulate that here in the Western world, but there may be bad actors that will just go off and, who knows, you know, create abominations and you know, experiment and all the rest of it. Crisis of things to that nature. But greater regulation before it's too late, but at a faster cadence, which they're beginning to do, right? Like they only just got around in the last few years to addressing the, you know, impact of social media. We're seeing big tech on trial just recently. You know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, all the big players are you know, in front of your FTC and Department of Justice and things like that. And they are beginning to have those talks now, which is really promising to see, right? So they're beginning to actually speak with people and open up those lines of dialogue. But it should come down to more than just a handful of tech CEOs, really, to be sort of pushing this forward, or at least constructing the narrative in terms of where society goes in relation to AI.
This came up a little bit, but the incentivization structure of business, I feel like, is oftentimes like at odds with our morality. So, you know, one thing I was thinking about with your interview with Dr. Megan Lee, that was talking about the food industry, and she was saying, imagine a toy store where like everything on the edges is, you know, stuff that is fine for your kids to buy, but, and play with, but the stuff in the middle might kill them. Like, would you accept that, as a structure for a toy store? And with food, there's a direct profit incentive to, for example, make addictive foods that are bad for you that people will keep consuming. So Coca-Cola, as an example, when talked about from a business standpoint, it's held up as being aspired to, but they're selling and profiting off of something that people are being advised against drinking by the medical community. So, what role do you think financial incentivization plays in our health, and how do you think it could be changed or improved?
And that's a heavy one. That's a meaty question to get into, because it cuts to the core of society and things like capitalism and how businesses run and how they affect the economy and everything like that. And you're right, it's a profit incentive, right? You just look at it more broadly speaking. Who makes money if you and I eat healthy?
Right.
Who loses out on that, right? Like, you know, a lot of the time, so I'm plant-based and buy certain foods and don't buy certain foods. And, you know, I've had conversations with people where they've gone, oh, you know, and this is earlier on in sort of that journey where, you know, don't push your vegan stuff on me.
Right.
You know, that's all a conspiracy. And I'm thinking, who? Like the apple farmers? Is this like big apple farmer thing? Like what industry? I don't know. Big farm, not farmer? I don't know. Like, what are we talking about here? But how can it be improved? I think education, I think people sort of need to, because it's difficult, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult in terms of what choices people have and what impact people can actually affect. People acting individually cannot do all that much, but everyone acting in unison is pretty powerful and pretty amazing. And that's where you see things radically change. And it just comes down to education. Again, sort of delaying that gratification, that low-hanging fruit of, well, there's a thing in the store that's a dollar and I'm going to eat that. That's quick, that's easy, it's low cost. And sometimes that's the only choice people can have for monetary reasons, for convenient, like whatever it is. But, you know, really having a think about what you're putting in your body, what you're, how you're spending your money and whether or not those things serve you, really taking a critical lens to the decisions you make as a consumer. And that can go back to our earlier questions about data and privacy and AI. I mean, it's a thread that can sort of weave right through every decision you make as a consumer. What's the impact of this on me, on my health, on the environment, on those around me, on local industries, on small stores, everything? So education, I think, will play a big part and is sort of the only card people can play, to be honest, is to become educated about things. Yeah.
In your end of the season recap of New Ways, you put together a montage of people answering the question, what is a modern remedy? And a theme I noticed that surfaced throughout those answers is the concept of identifying your values and aligning yourself with them. How do you feel that applies in your own life? And where does your motivation towards sustainability come from?
Yeah, so I'm no expert. I'm not perfect. I do the best that I can, but that's a driving force for me. That's sort of my North Star, is to do the best that I can. So never resting on my sort of laurels there. And I think it gives you a sense of credibility. I think if you care about the environment, it's probably a good idea not to drive like a Hummer. I think if you care about your health, it's probably a good idea not to smoke at the gym. Things like that, you know, really just sort of act in accordance with your values, walk the talk. And so for me, it's evaluating how I live my life, what I do, what I choose to, everything I just talked about, right? Like what I choose to consume. And sometimes just looking at things and going, hey, these, like recently we've got a green waste, right? So there's a collection of green waste where we live, which is, you know, your tree clippings and your food waste and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of had a look at that a few weeks ago and I went, could we not make our own compost? Could we not go and actually get a compost bin and actually begin to sort of create fertilizer and soil? Like, is there something better to be done here? And went away and researched it. And so we decided, yeah, that's actually a really good idea. And so we've eliminated one of our means of waste completely from our household. We don't throw away any food waste. Everything gets sort of turned into compost. The worms are really enjoying it. Everybody's happy. And it's just, you know, you don't have to be so meticulous with things, you know, do what you can, but never stop wanting to do better, I think, is the engine behind a lot of that. And then in terms of why I care about sustainability or what was my motivation behind caring about it, is that early on in my life, I knew I wanted to help people somehow. And that was, well, just, you know, contribute to the economy, have a job, you know, you're good in things like tech and the rest of it and design, do that. That will help people. And well, okay, it's not really helping people. It's kind of like supporting them or something for them to buy. I don't know if that's really helping them. So pivot to psychology and going away and getting credentials there. And then again, it's like, well, I'm helping people one-on-one, which is important. It's important. We need counselors, we need psychologists, we need psychiatrists. But I wanted to do more at scale. So that became like, okay, what about creating some sort of digital platform where I can interact with people like yourself, change makers, brands and businesses that want to do good and really focus on that aspect of things to affect positive change at scale. And one of my, I guess I've always sort of cared about the environment to different degrees, but I think everyone cares about the environment to different degrees. I think there's a latent care about the home, the shared home that we have, that everybody has. And my reasoning is that, well, without, like, you can care about so many things in this world. If we don't have a home, if we don't have a planet to live on, none of that matters. Like, nothing that anybody does, anyone does, sort of matters if the world is on fire. Like, you can have the nicest home on the nicest street filled with everything you can possibly think of. If that house is literally on fire, that's your number one Maslow's hierarchy of needs. That's your right. That's your baseline thing that you have to sort of fix. And that's where we're at now. And we have to fix a lot of these issues that we have in the world. You know, there's innumerous to sort of list here, but, you know, everyone sort of gets the gist of the climate crisis and things like that. That is a pressing need, and that's where I've chosen to sort of apply my services.
We've touched on this just a little bit, but yeah, how do you see the balance between the individual and institutional responsibilities? How do you think those two roles kind of break down?
It's an interesting question. It's one I actually asked a guest about 2 weeks ago, a founder of an environmental group who they work with cleaning up the oceans. And I said that to him, but I added a third wheel there, a third leg of the chair there, and presented that to him as a pie chart, because this is how I think about it. I said, like, if we're talking about individuals, businesses, and governments, who has the bigger slice of responsibility? So you have to answer the question. You cannot sort of go, well, you know, everyone needs to do their part. You really got to go, these people do this much. And that led to a pretty healthy discussion where effectively, and I tend to agree with him, governments, that's where it sort of begins and ends, right? Because as people, we've got limited options, limited choices afforded to us by companies who are operating with a profit incentive, who won't take, I don't say they won't do the right thing, but that's not their primary focus. It's money. It's shareholder value. ESG has come in, but is sort of being laughed back out, which is quite unfortunate. Governments compel industries and businesses to do the right thing through regulation, other means. Then the businesses can afford us better choices to make in terms of sustainability, environment, health, everything else. And then we go and consume that. And that's a good cycle when it's working. So I'd say that it's a triad. It's not just a duopoly. And governments need to be brought in there, and that's the pressure. I'm not saying we need to store many government buildings or anything, but we do need to keep them accountable, right? We need to hold them accountable for things, and they need to take action effectively. And it needs to be known that, hey, we're not going to I'm not trying to radicalize anyone here, but that, you know, we're not cool with what's going on. And our voice is louder than the lobbying power of businesses. And so you need to listen to your people, because at the end of the day, we're all people. We are all individuals. Some of us have more power than others. Some of us have the ability to affect policy. Some don't. But I still say that we have some impact on that policy being made. So governments is my answer to that question.
in one of my previous interviews that was actually with neuroscientist Anjan Chatterjee, and he said in our interview that when we talk about the value of art to other people who agree, we're preaching to the choir. So the real challenge is to convince people who don't agree that it's important that it is. And I feel like the same could be said for environmentalism. Like, it's easy to talk to like-minded individuals, but what about converting the other side?
It's something that I think everyone is going to come across when they first become passionate about thing or whatever it is, right, that you sort of care about. You will run out and tell everyone, I've learned a thing and here's why you should also do the thing that I've learned. And that doesn't work. People don't like their reality being changed. People like to know, you know, they put their key in the door, it opens. When they put the TV on at 7, the thing is on that they want to watch or whatever it is, right? Especially in today's sort of incredibly fast-moving and rapidly evolving sort of landscape that we have and all the things going on in the world. You want to know this is this and I don't want that challenged. And so for good or for bad, if you present something to someone, hey, you know, you shouldn't, you know, at the beginning of this conversation, don't use AI because it's bad for the environment. There's going to be people who are going to go, no, I don't want to hear what this guy has to say. And that's not what we were saying, but someone will hear that, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who's really into AI will hear that and go, hey, I'm not interested in that. And that's unfortunate because then we obviously got to solutions, right? Which is a big focus of everything that I try to do. So it comes down to communication, empathy, and trust, right? Like, don't blast people with your point. Sort of see where they're at, try to find a compromise, show them that little change is actually required that won't sort of disrupt their reality. I can think about things like one of my friends, he said, oh, I want to do more, the environment and everything. It's okay. And I said, well, what do you wash your clothes with? He's like, what do you mean? I go, well, what do you use to wash your clothes? Oh, you know, and whatever the brand was, it's this off-the-shelf thing. I went, okay, at that store, because I go to the same store, there is a dishwashing liquid that you can, a clothes detergent that you can use, which is, I think it's about $2 or $3 Australian, so not very much at all. It's in recycled plastic reclaimed bottle. It's vegan-friendly. It's plant-based. It's not going to hurt the planet. It's not going to hurt people. It's not going to hurt the environment. It's good times. And it doesn't cost any different. It might actually cost less than the thing that you're buying now. Oh, really? Okay, yeah. They used it. They came back. You know that stuff that you recommended? Yeah, that's really good, actually. And I feel good that I'm helping the environment. And it's like, yeah, there you go. They didn't have to compromise anything. I showed them some incentives. I gave them some incentives. You know, it's going to cost less. It's convenient. It's right there. It's next to the one that you currently use. You probably never saw it or recognized it or whatever. And there you go. And you're able to, you know, sort of, I was able to break through based on things like empathy, communication, and trust. They trust me as a friend. You know, we're empathetic to the same values. I was able to communicate in a pleasant, digestible way that they should be taking a look at other options, and they decided to do it. Now, if I yelled and screamed at that person, what are you doing? Why don't you use lemon juice and something else to wash your clothes? It's more sustainable. I'm not going to get very far. I'm not going to get very far at all, right? And I think that's a common mistake that many people will make. I know I did, right? I know when I first went plant-based, I ran around like Soylent Green telling everyone, you know, don't eat animals and what are you doing? And you, it's a challenge, right? Whether it's animals, whether it's people, whether it's the environment, there's usually a pressing need. And it's, what if I don't do anything? If I don't tell everyone, no one will do anything. But you've got to take a step back and go, okay, no one's going to listen to you if you scream. No one's going to care. You're actually going to hurt yourself because people are going to go, well, I'm not listening to that guy or girl. Put a circle around them. They're crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So I choose the lighthouse model, which is copyright me, I don't know. but sort of shine a light on solutions, shine a light on possibilities. You know, if you consume any of the writing that we do over at A Modern Remedy, you'll see that you're always left with actionable insights. It's not, I mean, there's enough media out there that says the world is effed, everything's bad. So that doesn't help anyone. And I don't want to add to that noise, but I want people to feel empowered. I want them to feel, not just feel, but actually know that they can make a difference. So instead of running around telling people don't eat animals or think about animal cruelty or whatever, I went and like ran a marathon. And then people would say, wait, wow, you know, what'd you do to train? I said, this, this, and this. Oh, okay. And what'd you eat? Naturally, it would come up. Well, this, this, and this. Really? As a vegan? Aren't you tired all the time? What about this? What about that? No. And, oh, okay. And I actually, out of that, I had about a half dozen friends, I don't say convert, but begin adopting more plant-based food and meals and things like that into their lifestyles just off that. So You can affect a lot more change if you're coming from a place of empathy with people, realize where they're at, realize what they're sort of willing to do, and maybe go just a little bit outside the comfort zone. But as well, it's not just because you need to obviously have incentives there. This is better for you financially, health-wise, the environment. And people, back to Maslow, people generally, I think, want to do good. It just comes down to whether or not they're in a position to do that. I think most people are. I think most people can do a lot more than they think that they can. And yeah, it's just about tapping into that.
Just in terms of approaching people with empathy, trust, what were the other elements?
So empathy and trust and effective communication.
Yes. And I feel like that's becoming a really big problem with the siloing effect of social media and having like political discussions or like, you know, choosing sides sort of discussions within the social media realm. I feel like the problems just are becoming exacerbated and making people fight because nobody is approaching with any of those elements, you know?
Yeah, it's curious because on one hand, we were able to exist, let's go back 10, 20 years or whatever, before this sort of social media influence, we were able to sort of coexist around politics. You may not like the person that's running the country, but you go, yeah, well, you know, that's the president or the prime minister or the whoever. Yeah, you know, I respect them, but I didn't vote for them, but I don't like all their policies, but they're not doing too bad on this one, whatever. And you kind of don't have any strong feelings, or at least in Australia, you wouldn't really care. You might, oh, they're doing a bad job on, I don't know, tax or something, but you generally, that's it. You sort of, it was almost more like sports here, really. Like, oh, my, you know, parents voted for these people, so I'll vote for them. And that's kind of how it went, right? But then I think we're seeing an unwinding, a natural unwinding of humans weren't all meant to gather in massive groups all at once. We're sort of not wired to have that many people in our purview and keep up with that level of information. We're used to smaller tribes. So that's good and bad, right? Because as you said, there's a siloing effect happening where people are really sort of becoming radicalized within their own little fiefdoms. Not a good thing. You need that open line of communication so things don't go sour. But then at the same time, there is actually a mental health benefit of not trying to keep up with 1,000 people on your social media feed. That's just never going to happen. You're not going to feel good about yourself at the end of the day. So where that's all going, I'm still not sure. I think there'll be more of it. I think, and there's a piece I'd written called ineffectively sort of, it touched on the winding back of social media, which is what we're seeing. People are moving to things like Discord. They're moving to private communities. Web 4.0, I think, will be more of that. I think people are going to move to smaller and smaller groups. How we're going to avoid those groups not getting along with each other, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. I only have one more question for you, and I wanted to ask you your own signature question, which is what is a modern remedy for what we're seeing today, sort of like everything that we've been talking about? which nice. I feel like, yeah, you've gone over a lot of it, but yeah, if you have like an involved thought about a modern remedy.
It's that. Mm. It's thought. Mm-hmm. It's thinking. And you might say, hey, that's not new. We've been thinking for a long time, right? What are you talking about? I don't think we have been thinking for a while. I think for a while we've been asleep at the wheel. I think we've been taking things too easily. Everything was too simple. You didn't have to think. There's a lot of things in society that are sort of wired that way where it's like, whatever, veg out in front of the TV or on your phone, scroll some more. Don't think, just buy, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to bring thinking back, you know, critical thinking, as like what I said at the beginning, you know, or about the, what's the effect of AI? What's the effect of Bitcoin? What's the effect of things like, you know, trading my data so I can play a game on my phone or something? What's the environmental impact of those things? What's the effect of food? What's the impact of the food that I choose to buy? What am I doing? How am I contributing to society? What am I doing with my time? Is this thing serving me? How could I be kinder? How could I be nicer to people? All those things, really thinking about everything. You know, we're at the dawn of a new era, you know, with AI, which threatens human thinking. I myself personally am not ready to outsource my cognition to a computer, but I know a lot of people that are, I just typed a thing into here and it did a thing and then I hit publish. And that's a bit sad, I think. I think that there's going to be whole generations of people that are not going to know what's good and what's bad, that won't know the quality or the beauty that comes with creating art or the fun in solving a problem, creatively or otherwise, right? Or just getting that note just right and that you did that. You know, I opted to pay someone to make the intro jingle and all of the audio elements in our show. I could have done that with AI, but I went and I found someone who really is quite passionate about music and elected to hire them. And we, you know, worked on the theme, and that's what we use. And when it's time to change up the theme, I'll do it again. You know, I don't use things like ChatGPT in my writing. I go out and do research and I learn a hell of a lot about things. And I go away and put those through, you know, filters of critical thinking and analysis and just using that big, beautiful, mushy pink thing in our heads, right? Actually using it that we all have. Thinking can be applied to so many problems. And sometimes it will help, right, to augment that thinking, you know, with medicine, with science, using tools like AI, but as tools, not to replace your own ability to think.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.